Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the 2020 Camden Conference. The theme of this year's conference is Media Revolution, Changing the World. This is the last segment of a three-part Speaking in Maine series focusing on the Camden Conference. First, we will hear from Maria Reza, CEO, executive editor, and founder of Rappler.com. The title of her talk is Fighting Back with Data. Then we'll hear from Lydia Cacho, an investigative journalist, social activist, and human rights advocate. Her talk is titled, Journalism That Tells the Truth, A Task for the Brave. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speakers today is David Roncaccio, the host of Marketplace Morning Report.
Very pleased to introduce Maria Reza, who comes to us from Rappler.com. That is a social news medium focused on social change. It is based in Manila, the Philippines. She's been recognized around the world for her courage fighting disinformation and fake news generated by the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, and his supporters. And she is currently awaiting a court's verdict in a suit brought against her in a move seen as a move to quash the work of Rappler and to intimidate other media in the Philippines. In 2018, she was named Time Magazine Person of the Year for her advocacy for press freedom, and she's received many other awards, as you'll see if you check out the bio. Her topic this afternoon, again, right on point, Fighting Back with Data, and will help us understand what it takes to risk censorship and intimidation and how to push back on it. Let us welcome to the stage Maria Reza from the Philippines, Rappler.com. You are next. Sorry. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. This is my 34th year being a journalist. I spent 20 years running bureaus for CNN in Jakarta and in Manila. And then I went home. I decided to go back to the Philippines. I headed the largest news group, which is now under attack by President Duterte. And then I decided I was going to catch the technology, run with it, right? Do something new. So let me show you what we did. There's three things I wanted to talk about. All right, so the first is, let's just state the problem, and the problem is very simple. We're at an existential moment for journalism, and when journalists are under attack, democracy is under attack. In my case, I will show you how our democracy crumbled within 6 months, our institutions crumbled, and how we came under attack. 11 cases and investigations in a little over a year, that's what I faced. And in order to be here in front of you today, I had to post bail 8 times. I paid more in bonds and bail than Imelda Marcos, who's been convicted in 4 different countries, right? So, defining the problem, that's one. Second problem, let's not call it social media. Let's call it a behavioral modification system. And we are Pavlov's dogs, because we walked into this. Technology has been the accelerant that has helped bring to power authoritarian-style leaders who have slowly turned their democracies into dictatorships. Why the Philippines, number two? Why are we a case study? Because 100% of Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. Facebook is our internet. And when I set up Rappler, I helped. Rappler actually helped spread Facebook because our fast growth, we went from 12 people to 75 people in about a year and a half, and we became the third top online news site in a year and a half, competing against the largest television news group, right? That's kind of unheard of. That was in 2012. So I drank the Kool-Aid. We know the empowering effects of social media. We were able to use it for disaster risk reduction, but we were also the first to feel the attacks, and I'll show you what that looks like. Cambridge Analytica's whistleblower, Chris Wiley, he focused on the Philippines, and he said, he called us the Petri dish. He said that Cambridge Analytica tested out these tactics of mass manipulation in the Philippines and countries like ours in the Global South. And then when they worked, the word he used is ported it over to the United States and Europe. You know the description of the Philippines? This is from Stanley Carnot. He wrote a book called In Our Image. He's a former New York Times reporter. He said that the Philippines spent 450 years in a convent and 50 years in Hollywood. We're the only colony of the United States. We're a former protectorate. And digital products are tested for you first in the Philippines. So we're kind of like your guinea pig. So think about it like this. Our dystopian present is your dystopian future. And then, I'm not gonna depress you. There are solutions. We will find them. And you know, we have to find them. I've been talking, a lot of this stuff I've been talking about for 3 years, because that's when we first started, my pants are falling. That's when we first started, that's when we first started doing this disinformation stuff in 2016. And you know, you'll see some things that seem familiar because they are, because you are living through the same things. So solutions are possible. Oh, did I mention I wouldn't have the problems I'd have if Silicon Valley didn't do the things it did? That's the first step. So the empowerment actually comes, and the solution will come from you. In 2018, there was a cover with four. And in every single one of the cover of Time Magazine's Person of the Year, journalists were killed, imprisoned. The Capital Gazette, the journalists were killed. The Myanmar journalists were still in prison at that point. The brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi shook all of us around the world. And then there was me. And when I first saw this on Twitter, I thought it was fake, so I sent it to our social media team to check. And then when it was real, CNN called me like a second later. I felt like I got punched in the stomach because it meant I would get more attacks by the government, right? So it was either, I couldn't figure out whether it was good or not. But I think in the end it helped put a shield. 2017, so here's the way the attacks worked. The astroturfing on social media, exponential attacks, happened exactly a year before the same lies came top down from President Duterte himself. So 2016, social media, the weaponization of social media. Then 2017, in his State of the Nation address, President Duterte said that we were American owned. We're not. A week later, I got my first subpoena. And then in 2018, 11 cases and investigations. In 2019, a year ago today, I was arrested for the first time. 5 weeks later, I was arrested again, and then I'm out on bail on eight different charges. 2020 is the year to fight back. And this begins here in the United States. So guys, please do something with your elections. It starts with you, because it all goes downhill, right? So here's the thing. This is the way I define the problem. 3 years ago, it's on this side. If you make people believe lies are the facts, then you can control them. This one comes from Tim Snyder. He wrote a book called On Tyranny, and he said something really simple. This is on an MSNBC. He said, if you want to rip the heart out of a democracy, you go after facts. That's what modern authoritarians do. Step one, you lie all the time. Step two, you say it's your opponents and the journalists who lie. Step three, everyone looks around and says, what's the truth? There is no truth. Then resistance is over. It's impossible, right? It's impossible and the game is over. The question I ask Rappler all the time is, what does civic engagement look like in the age of social media when we have alternative realities? But the reality is, there aren't alternative realities. There are facts. There's one person standing on stage waving her hands. right? That's a fact. It's not debatable. Unless I pound it a million times, I have bots, I pay people, and I say there are 100 people on stage, and someone will believe it. Most will believe it because it will spread faster on social media. The biggest problem is this: a lie told a million times becomes a fact. Without the facts, you can't have truth. Without truth, you can't have trust. If you have no facts, no truth, no trust, you have no democracy. This is what we need to fight for. Here's what it looked like in the Philippines. And this was from 2017. This is a study that we had done with Jigsaw. Patriotic trolling, that's what we called it. State-sponsored online hate and harassment campaigns to silence and intimidate. There are two ways they attack you. They pound you to silence, and then they incite other people to attack, incite hate. And this happens exponentially. When we did our first propaganda war series in 2016, I got an average of 90 hate messages per hour. It's a new weapon. And women in the Philippines are targeted at least 10 times more than men. And the attacks, as you can see, are here. Instead of censoring, you just flood the market with lies because people can't tell the difference. The First Amendment, the freedom of speech, guys, it doesn't work when you have no rules of the marketplace. So here are the steps in the Philippines. The three, and they worked for me. They worked for a senator, Lila de Lima, who is spending this month her third year in prison without a proper trial. She was the former head of the Commission on Human Rights, Justice Secretary, and the senator whom President Duterte decided to make an example of. First, you attack the credibility. You allege corruption. You repeat it a million times. I took care of my reputation for 30 some odd years. That's all a journalist has. Imagine, how do I fight back against somebody saying she's a criminal? She's corrupt, 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 corrupt. Two, use sexual violence, and I'll show you an example of these. You inflame the biases, fuel misogyny. You degrade that person as a sexual object. And we saw this with Lila de Lima, much like with Rana Ayub in India, with her sexualized gender violence video that was doctored. It was one of our congressmen threatened to show it in Congress. And then three, they trended a few weeks before she was arrested. They trended hashtag arrest Lila de Lima. When it trended, well, a few weeks later, she was arrested. That was 3 years ago. With me, in May 2017, they tried to trend hashtag arrest Maria Ressa. It didn't trend, which is probably why it took another 2 years before they actually arrested me. So this is what it looks like. Let me show you what hashtag arrest Maria Ressa looks like. And again, this is something I've been living with for 3 years. Here we go. So it starts here on Facebook. Remember, Facebook really is our internet. We published the transcript of the conversation between Duterte and Trump. And this blogger, this person, not a fake account, publishes this. He posts this on Facebook. Rappler just made the Philippines a legitimate target of North Korean missiles. I mean, I laugh, but people believe it. And then from there, it jumps to a Twitter account, a campaign machinery that then was weaponized, right? And on the Twitter account, it says, ipatawag na yan sa Senado, hashtag arrest Maria Ressa, call her to the Senate. I was called to the Senate 2 years later. They didn't quite trend it. Maybe that's why it's like fertilizer on the ground, right? Then from there, now we walk into the real people. I can smell an arrest and possible closure of Rappler.com. Well, yes, I was arrested in 2019, and yes, in January 2018, the government tried to close us down. This is in May 2017, for the record. Then it jumps to the sexual attacks. Maybe Maria Ressa's dream is to become the ultimate porn star in a gangbang scene. Well, no, it's not. But this was posted, seen by millions, and then it goes to this last one, which was on Rappler's page, me to the RP government, make sure Maria Ressa gets publicly raped to death when martial law expands to Luzon. It would bring joy in my heart. The only defense I had is to post it on my Facebook page, and when I did, his school contacted me. He's a senior in college, right? So this is the information warfare Courtney told you about. I live it, my country lives it, and it breaks my heart. Also because of the values, right? We haven't really talked about that. We need to figure out what values do you stand for? All right, let me show you some data. Let me get water. I still have 15. So what we did in Rappler is we started to look at the data. We looked at our own data. We scraped our data. We're alpha partners of Facebook. Facebook and I are frenemies. We're one of two Facebook fact-checking Filipino partners. And what we do is content moderation is a whack-a-mole game for me. Once you find the lie, you look for the network that spreads the lies. Take a look here at how from April 2015 to April 2016, Duterte was elected here. Look at the words that were attacking journalists. Bayaran means corrupt. Let's just look at that top one. You can see it. There's a grain of truth, right? Corruption is endemic in the Philippines. So there's a grain of truth, but you can see it was heavily pounded during the campaigns. And by the time Duterte was elected here, he used it all the time because he would attack. So the attacks would come both bottom up and top down. And by October 2016, it's a fact. Journalists are corrupt, right? That's one way to change the narrative. This is what we did for my social media team. I told you we were born on social media, right? So what we did is we took all of the networks of disinformation. And for my social media team, who's a very young team, and that I mentioned, Rappler's about 100 people, were 63% women, and the median age is 23 years old. We're young. I'm old, but my team is young. Oh, 23 years old is the median age in the Philippines. So what's this? These are the URLs of the websites that share, that have lies on them, fake news and quotes. These are the Facebook pages that actually spread these URLs. And then I look here at the average reposting time, right? Anytime it's reposted more than 10 times, it turns red. I want to show you what happened after we posted the story in October 2016 that showed the Duterte propaganda machine. It turned red. And we looked at Sally Mata. It's a Facebook page that attacked all of the news groups in the Philippines. And you can see here, it's a cut and paste account. And they use Duterte and Marcos campaign pages to cascade. Sacha Cohen talked about how, you know, freedom of speech is not freedom of reach. This is reach, right? And you can see it. It is cut and paste. It is manipulated to make you think that that's the zeitgeist. This is the attack on the vice president of the Philippines. In the Philippines, she is the lead opposition. And when it comes like this, it looks kind of really boring. But if I put it like this in a network map, you'll see that the same three accounts, the bloggers and the content creators, are so organized that they're broken down by demographics. This account takes care of this is the one that began the attack against our vice president because it is kind of like, I call it a pseudo-thinking class. it's supposed to try to target the thinking class. This account, this is the one that targets the middle class. And then this account was a singer-dancer, kind of like a more salacious Spice Girls, but she's now a government official. But this forms the foundation of our information ecosystem. This is the same network that attacked not just the vice president, but attacks me, attacks Rappler, attacks journalists. From there, that same attack against the vice president jumped to Manila Times, is an old newspaper in the Philippines, but its chairman emeritus was named the head of international public relations for Duterte. It's essentially an echo, and it jumps, the lies jump from social media. This account has a column inside Manila Times and other things. It's a direct conduit to the government. From there, it jumps to state media. And around this time period, our state media proudly announced that they were working closely with China and Russia. And our Philippine news agency went, and I don't think they realized that they shouldn't be putting up pictures of them visiting the Sputnik offices in Moscow. So we did a story on it, they got mad, they took down their pictures, but there you go. Then we closed that loop by putting the content creators in government office. And this is in 2017. She headed social media for the palace for eight months, and then she resigned and is now working for Overseas Workers Welfare of the Philippines. Marcoses are back. This is how historical revisionism happens on social media. It isn't just by doing one post saying Marcos is great or even trying to convince you to vote for Marcos. It is death by a thousand cuts. Look at what it shows. It's astroturfing, the same message, different accounts, and it's very simple. It's just moving you slightly to believe that the martial law days weren't so bad after all, right? Dark part, my parents even say you can watch TV and news, roam the streets. Here I believe the dark narration and the full twisting of this part of history. During my elementary high school days, it wasn't all dark. The historians and maybe media made it all dark. This month is the 34th anniversary of People Power, which ousted Ferdinand Marcos, ended 21 years of his dictatorship. His daughter is now a senator, won re-election. His wife is in Congress. They're back. So let me show you natural language processing. I have 9 minutes left. So I want to show you how else media is controlled. This is taking natural language processing and going through everything written during the time when the government threatened to arrest me. And I use this because I want you to see how hanging a Damocles sword over journalists affects their coverage. In this one, you can see that 34% of the stories that were triggered by the release of a Department of Justice press release. I won one award, I was in Washington, D.C. The government released a press release saying that I would get convicted of something. There are 11 charges, I can't remember which one. And so they had this. So the blue, 34% of the stories came from the Philippines. But then, if you look at the theme of these stories, right? So these are stories that were largely from the Philippines. 27% of all of the clusters of stories just wrote exactly what the Department of Justice said. I'd be arrested, I could go out on bail, and then it listed the cases against me. But it was the stories from the United States that called it a Duterte rights crackdown. Our news groups couldn't yet do that, couldn't yet say that. This was a year ago. This year, we're getting better at it in the Philippines, right? We know when it's time to stop negotiating. The sizes of the circles are based on eigenvector centrality. So the larger the circle, the more influential the Facebook account. This is what it looks like. The larger, this is our Facebook community, our information ecosystem. And you can see it is asymmetrical warfare. The pro-Duterte, pro-Marcos communities are overwhelming and they use mimetic warfare. Memes, right? It's just to make you laugh. It's thinking fast, thinking slow, and thinking fast always wins over thinking slow, right, in the age of social. This I show you because this is the first time I was arrested. It was Valentine's Day last year. The government held me overnight and they released me, and it was the first time that that asymmetrical warfare became even. But what was interesting is this, and the same thing has happened in the US. The people who wanted to challenge Duterte would share news from traditional news groups, from credible news groups. But the pro-Duterte, pro-Marcos accounts refused to share traditional news groups. So you can see the coordinated action here. And what they were doing is actually looking for something like an Alex Jones. They were looking to create one. If Mocha had been better at it, maybe she would have been that account. But so far, they were looking for something. Despite that, again, when you pound something a million times, you just create it. So this is one of those times when the asymmetrical warfare became even. And then the other time, the only other time we ever won on social media was when U2 came to Manila and Bono dedicated Ultraviolet to women, Filipino women, and he mentioned me, and we had something similar to this. I don't know what that means yet, but I need to show you that it is possible for news groups to survive and do well. Rappler is 8 years old this year, and look, I was always meaning to break even in our fifth year. So here's 2012. This one, please don't tweet, but someone asked the question last night. Yes, it is possible to do well and to find a new business model away from advertising. So our goal here was always to break even in 2016. Our first month of positive net income was April 2016, 1 month before Duterte took office. The attacks began a month after he took office. So you can see the impact of the attacks on Rappler. Here's the revenue stream. It completely died. I had begun hiring for tech and data. And then what we did is we slashed our budget to deal with these attacks. We maintained the revenue we were making because we were building a new revenue stream. We slashed our budgets by taking the founders and cutting our pay by 20%. And then we gave a 4% increase to our rank and file. And guess what, in 2019, we actually made money. Here, we made money and we expect to make more in 2020. And once the audited numbers come out, I plan to give a bonus straight across the board for Rapplers, because it was a tough year. Let me show you what a diversified revenue stream looks like. This red, that's advertising. So this is how we began, all advertising, right? Look at what happened when the attacks began here, and then advertising. So the first thing that happens when you're attacked by your government is advertisers leave you. By April 2018, when I had three cases, we dropped 50% of our revenue. And I knew that if we didn't find an alternative business model, that we would die. So what we did is we took the disinformation networks, we took the things we were doing as journalists, building communities, because that's still the question. How do you build communities of action in the age of social media? And then we began a new business that deploys business to business, so the advertisers aren't straight up front. That's this. And you can see in 2018, we started it, it was fledgling, but by mid-2019, it had grown 2,000%. And in 2019, it was neck and neck with our advertising. And the other thing that we did is, right here, a very small membership, crowdfunding and membership. We started in December of 2018, a membership drive that actually has brought in our most active communities. They believe in the same values. We are fighting for our democracy, and I pretty much say this bluntly, in the age of the battle for truth, journalism is activism. There's no debate. You fight for the truth. That's what our community does. They also, by the way, with the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Press Freedom Defense Fund, crowdfunded a legal defense fund. And that's part of the reason. So, you know how much I pay in legal fees? It's a third of what I normally pay for all of Rappler. And at the beginning, I wasn't sure how we would do it, but our community helped us. That's incredible. So in 2020, we have a new platform that's coming out. We need to fight technology with technology. And guess what? A journalist making a decision on what tech to deploy and how to deploy and where to draw the lines will make very different decisions from a coder, from a tech person, because the very problem began with one very simple decision made by a tech person on social media. And you know what that is? I simplified it this way. When they wanted to grow their social media platform, they decided to seed what would divide our societies. One decision. It was to make us grow their platform by putting friends of friends. And that decision, friends of friends, growing that way, meant that they divided us like this. It is built into the design of the platforms, right? I'm gonna just end with another minute of a video. So you see it's not just Rappler. There's a lot more that's happened since then. It's Filipino journalists holding the line.
Have you ever been harassed because of your work?
Yes.
Have you been threatened online?
Ay, oo.
Have you been called biased?
Yes.
Have you been called stupid?
Yes, plenty times, by idiots.
Have you been called disrespectful?
Yes.
Have you been accused of corruption?
Yes.
Have you been called ugly as a response to any story?
Yes.
Have you been called fake news?
Oh yeah, they always say I'm fake news. Anything that's critical is fake, right?
Have you been accused of being an imperialist spy?
Yes.
Have you been accused of being a communist operative?
Yes.
Have you been accused of working for the CIA?
Yes.
Have you been sexually harassed as a journalist?
Yes.
Has your family been threatened, harassed, or alluded to?
Yes, it has. Specifically my daughter. When she died, there were a lot of people who made fun of that.
Have you been threatened with rape?
Yes.
Yes.
No, not me, but my family.
Have you been threatened with violence?
Yes.
Have you been threatened with death?
Yes.
Have you been told how you're going to be killed?
Yes.
Has the violence been described to you?
Yeah, blow my head off, or bury me alive.
What will stop you from reporting?
Nothing.
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 Death?
You have to kill me.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. You just heard from Maria Reza speaking about the importance of journalism and truth-telling. Next, you'll hear from Lydia Cacho, who will be introduced by David Brancaccio.
Very honored to have Lydia Cacho. Now, she has managed to work in one of the Western Hemisphere's most dangerous countries for people in the media. And she will tell us, if you're determined to tell the stories that people in power don't want the public to know, you risk everything. Amnesty International has called her Mexico's most famous investigative journalist and women's rights advocate. Lydia Cacho, in a few moments, will present on the topic of journalism that tells the truth and is a task for the brave. Lydia Cacho, thank you for coming to us.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, I want to ask you a very weird question. Can you look at your hands? Just look at them. That means you're alive. I am alive today because I had to run away from home, Mexico, because I am a journalist and I'm a human rights activist. They tried to kill me. They went inside my house, killed my dogs, and tried to kill me. And I had to flee last July. That was the seventh time in my life as a journalist that I had to flee my home in order to stay alive. I'm not gonna depress you, I swear. Not more than we already have a little, but. So I want to talk to you about what it means for a lot of us to be journalists that have become activists and that are aware that it's the new journalism that is truly saving our communities. And if we do that all over the world, we will end up changing the narrative of journalism and using the media as a revolutionary tool. And that's what we have been trying to do. That's what I do. And I will tell you a short story about this. I began doing journalism in 30 years ago. And the first pieces I wrote about were about violence against women. And then I started writing about how the government of Quintana Roo, where Cancun is, in the southeast of Mexico, were not giving medicine to people with HIV in a touristic area, which there was a lot of sex tourism, and specifically male prostitution. And the governor called my house. My poor ex-husband had to answer the phone to threaten me because I was telling a lie. This is 25 years ago. He had to use the phone. Back then, he didn't have Twitter. So he had to use the phone, and he called me. He said, in my state, that does not happen. And I answered, well, in your state, it doesn't happen. In my country, in my state, it happens, and I have the facts. And that's what I published. And the next day, I published that the governor just called me and threatened me for like 2 weeks. It was the first experience in my life to have this. For like 2 weeks, I had this policeman outside my house following me everywhere because I was a threat to the governor, apparently, because I was talking about HIV/AIDS. So what happened later was that a lot of people started coming to the newspaper, and young people, young men, started coming to the newspaper and asking for this weird feminist journalist called Lydia Cacho that was writing about their rights and telling the stories and chronicles and talking about the Social Security and talking about the hospitals that were denying them service. And then all of a sudden, I had all these young men in my office at the newspaper, and then my editor-in-chief called me and he goes, Lydia, get them out of here. So I got out in the street and I was like, so aware of what being a journalist was. That was the first time in my life that I thought, this is what I'm gonna do the rest of my life. I am so so aware of the fact that my education and the ethics and the values that my parents and everyone around me gave me when I was a little girl became a reality as a journalist. So I helped these kids and I said, listen, we have to open something. So we ended up opening this house where they could get the health services. And I kept writing about these things. And then somebody picked it up on a newspaper in Mexico City. And these people that were working with people with HIV/AIDS helped them. And there were no social networks back then, apparently, not technological social networks. So everybody gathered together and this hospital, little hospital, became a reality in Cancun. So after that, my husband kept saying, you know, this is what true journalism should do. Always, always remember this. Years passed by, I kept on writing and investigating, and one day in 2003, these young girls escaped a man that was raping her, and she was 14 years old. And I started investigating the case. And then all of a sudden, I found out there were more and more girls and boys that were abused and exploited, sexually exploited,
in a fancy hotel in Cancun, and not all of them were Mexican. Some of them were American, some of them were middle class, and all of a sudden I knew it was something bigger than I ever thought. So I went to the authorities in Mexico City, to the special team, apparently specialized in crimes against children, and there weren't cyber crimes specialists back then, but they were supposedly experts in organized crime and knew about human trafficking. So I went there to interview them and ask them, what should the government do? What should the police do with these cases? And all of a sudden, they just laugh at me and they go like, are you crazy? You're making this up. There's no way, there's child pornography in Mexico the way you said. I mean, these kids must be lying, right? So I went back and I got inside the hotel of this guy. I got some information. I interviewed all these people. I had a TV program back then. I told the whole story in the TV program, and then they fired me from the TV station because these guys were really rich and powerful and friends of the governor. So I found out why they fired me, and I knew all the names of the governors involved, five governors involving the child pornography network, four senators, and I don't know how many hundreds of clients that they brought in and out from these fancy hotels to have sex with children from 4 years old to 14. So I investigated the whole thing, and then I started writing about it in the newspaper. And then the newspaper said, listen, Lydia, you know, this is really dangerous. And I went back to the federal police chief, and I asked him, how can we get into the place where they are sharing their information? And he goes, oh, are you crazy? They use these special programs, one called Thor. You have to be a hacker. Nobody should be a hacker. It's a crime. And, you know, this is not going to spread. You know, this is 2003, and, you know, internet is not going to be as powerful as you think. And, of course, this child pornography is not going to be as big as you think it's going to become. So I decided to prove him wrong by searching for the facts and believing all the stories the children were telling me. So I map out, whenever I work in one of my books, I have 16 books now, I map out everything. I have all the names of everyone. It's like what the maps that you saw there, I have that in my mind. That's what I do, and I bring it there. So anyway, I got all the names of everyone, and I started investigating these guys, and I ended up writing this book called Demons of Eden. My editors wanted to sell the book, so they call it that. But in the book, I named the names of everyone involved. But before that, in order to do the book, to write the book and to get the facts, I went to find somebody that could hack the deep web, because back then it wasn't that easy. Nowadays, it's just like, you know, something you do, but back then it wasn't that easy. So I went, you know, looking for these guys until I found this very young guy, and I asked him, you know, are you really a hacker? And he said, I can't tell you. And I showed him the evidence I gathered, and I said, I need to go into the deep web to prove these guys are connected. And they are sharing all this information, child pornography, and all their pictures and their videos having sex with these kids, but also the parties, which I didn't know, that they were having with kids, alcohol, bankers, and political party leaders. So he said, okay, I'll help you. He taught me. I became a hacker, don't tell anyone. And I hacked them, and all of a sudden I got into this world that I've never imagined in my entire life. I thought this was so overwhelming. I went straight to my family, I went straight to my therapist, and I was like, I cannot handle what I have in my head after watching these adults raping children and enjoying and partying over it and making business while they do it and celebrating. So I wrote the book. When I wrote the book, I had already had 7 death threats, one lawyer from one of the businessmen came to my office at the magazine I was working as an editor, and he put a gun in my face in front of the secretary, and he said, stop writing. And then I got all these calls, and one of the calls was like, if you keep writing about this case, your father will receive your body in little pieces in a bag, in a trash bag. And I told my family, I'm gonna write the book, and these are the threats, this is danger, you know, but I'm gonna do it. And all my family said, do it, we are behind you. My dad, my sisters and brothers, and my nieces, and most of my friends said, you're crazy, don't do it. Mainly my male friends said no. My female friends said, yes, go for it. So, you know. Anyway, I published a book, and 6 months later, I'm outside my office. These guys came, closed the street, dressed as civilians, these guys with guns took me, and they put me in a car, and they arrested me. Later, we found out they were policemen, ordered by one governor that was involved in this network. And they tortured me for 20 hours. They took me from Cancun to the city of Puebla near Mexico City. They tortured me during those 20 hours, and they were going to kill me. But they did not kill me, because before I published the book, I told the CPJ and everybody else that I was going to publish it. And I said, listen, if they kill me, if they arrest me, if they disappear me, anything, you have all the evidence here, and you have all the evidence of who did it. So my team was ready for anything that happened to me. People thought I was crazy, and I might be, but after you see the crimes they are committing against our children all over the world, you cannot stay quiet. You cannot, and you should not. Nobody should. So I ended up, instead of being dead, because all these people started calling Amnesty International, the CPJ, and everyone, so they called the governor, the president, and everyone, and say, if Lidia Cacho doesn't arrive alive to prison, where they were taking me, you're in trouble. So they took me to prison. I was in prison after being tortured, and they beat me inside prison, asking me if and when they let me out 7 years later, I could promise and sign a document in which I would say that I was treated properly and my human rights were not violated. And I said, of course, I will never talk about it. anyway, my lawyers were really good, and they let me out on bail. After 1 year, I won that battle. They put a lot of civil cases against me to destroy my economy, to take my house away, and things like that. That's what they do. And finally, we won the case against the leader of that child pornography network. And he got the first sentence ever in Latin America for child pornography and human trafficking, child trafficking. And the sentence is for 113 years, which is unbelievable for the continent, and unbelievable for Mexico, of course. I still, you know, they still want to kill me, of course, because they don't like me. But anyway, 3 years ago, I finally got the possibility to get incarcerated, the two policemen that tortured me, and they are now sentenced to 5 years. Because torture of journalists is apparently not a very big crime in Mexico, but they are in jail now, and I testified against them. And now I won in international courts, and the governors and the businessmen are now on the run because they have arrest warrants internationally. So that's one of the reasons why I cannot be at home right now, because they don't like what I did and what I keep doing, which is telling the truth. I've been writing about the same issue and other issues as human trafficking from all over the world, and trying to investigate all the mafias and how they link to bankers through money laundering, how they link to political parties, and how they use children and why child pornography is increasing all over the world. And to do so, I need social media. And what happened to me in 2003 when they thought this wasn't going to grow, and when I became a hacker and I thought this is gonna be a one-time thing, it became a big part of my job. And that's why I trained so many young journalists to do things like that. Because back then, after I got out of jail and my case became international, I started getting all these awards because I was like the crazy Mexican that was like a Shiro and this and that. And I became the story. I was really angry because I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be the story. I want to be the one that tells the story of the lives of others, the importance of saving their community and their children and the women and the men and stopping wars and things like that. I don't want to be the story, but I became the story. So I decided to use it, right? Especially to train journalists. And after I think it was the Washington Post or the New York Times said that I was the hero of Mexican journalism in Mexico, and I was so ashamed of that. And then one day I just took over that, and I said, if Mexican kids or Mexican journalists need a hero, then let it be. You know, I will be a hero for them, because otherwise the narco leaders or the criminal thugs or the corrupted governors are the heroes. So the guys who are killing thousands of people all over Mexico, portraying these narco movies and narco series, are becoming heroes. So we need more heroes in other places, and we should be aware of that. So anyway, while I was doing all my work as a journalist, at the beginning of getting out of jail, I start getting all these messages through my email. Because back then, I used to use Yahoo. I don't know, if somebody uses Yahoo, well, you know. or Hotmail, you know, changed. Anyway, I used to use Yahoo. And when I published my book, I thought, well, you know, nobody's going to read it. Who wants to read a book about a network, an international network of the rich guys, politicians that are doing child pornography? Nobody want to read that. So I published my email there in the book. And then all of a sudden, from my book went from 3,000 published books to 1 million books sold, only in Spanish. So all these people started writing to me and saying, my daughter disappeared, my little boy disappeared, and he, you know, and so I had like more than 100 cases every day. And I was like, people think that I am like a sort of some sort of general district attorney for the citizens, and I'm only a reporter, right? So I decided to create a network, which I was like sharing all the information with people that knew how to find girls and boys in different states in Mexico. And all of a sudden, this guy from London writes to me and he said, listen, Lydia, we have to create an international network to find these kids. So we did. So there were a big community of hackers helping each other to find kids and to find the pedophiles that were taking the pictures of children from their social networks, from their parents' social networks, and finding where they lived and taking them away. So then I asked myself, there's something wrong with police around the world, which is they are trying to, they have the Amber Alert, they look for children all over the world, but they look for the guys who are raping them or disappearing the kids, but they are not looking for all these children that are, the millions now of children that are in child pornography all over the networks. So that's what we decided to do, to look for them, and we do. We look for them, and we, in some cases, in some countries, we help the authorities to find them. And we have found a lot of children that have been kidnapped by child pornographers, and especially by human traffickers that want to, from selling organs to trying to sell them for sex. Now, Mexico, Russia, and the US are the three biggest producers and consumers of child pornography in the world. So we have a task here in front of us, and it has to do with good journalism. And how do we use social media in order to find out what's going on? We can use it the better way we can, which is never, never sharing a story or a profile of someone that is sharing child pornography in Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. They do all the time, even though you wouldn't believe it, they do it all the time. What we do is we gather all their data, and then we share it with different people, activists in different countries where they are at. And then we write stories about these guys. And then they, in some countries they are arrested, in some countries they are not. But a lot of journalists, especially my editor-in-chief of the newspaper I used to work for, they fire me because I'm a liability, apparently, because they want to kill me. And they don't want to defend me. Nobody wants to defend a journalist like me or like 100 more in Mexico that are doing things like what I do. So when he fired me, he told me, you know, you are doing the wrong thing. You are supposed to be, you are a wonderful journalist. You're an amazing storyteller. You should be there, you know, in the trenches, interviewing the women and the men and going there and interviewing the drug lords and doing the work that you know how to do. You have all these books, all these awards. You're wasting your time. You're not an activist. You are a journalist. And I look at him and I'm like, how old is he? And I'm like, how old are you? And he goes, I'm 72. And I'm like, okay, you're a journalist and you're sitting in your desk. You've been sitting in your desk like for 30 years. I've been a reporter for 30 years. I hardly sit in my desk, ever sit in my desk except for writing my pieces. All the rest of the time I'm traveling and investigating and listening to people and documenting and gathering true facts and evidence from everywhere and taking pictures. And I am a do-it-all woman, as most journalists are. And I said, so you're telling me that the narrative and the journalism that you learned 50 years ago is the one I should reproduce now? And I thought he was going to go, no, Lydia, yes, we have to discuss this. And you know, the answer was very funny for him. He just laughed at me and he said, listen, if you think you're going to change the world, you are crazy. The world will never change. And I said, listen, the world has changed. You are a very, very famous journalist and editor, and you have never won an award. And I am the most awarded journalist in Mexico, and I'm a female. I started writing when I was 23, and there weren't supposed to be women in any newspaper, except for the secretaries that we was used to be forced to wear miniskirts. So here we are. 60% of all journalists in Mexico are female. Things have changed a lot. Most of us use internet to do our work. I have been threatened a lot, of course. I get threats, all kinds of threats. For example, recently a governor said that I shouldn't be taken seriously because somebody posted a photo of me in her Facebook wearing a bikini. So I shouldn't be taken seriously because I wore a bikini. And they, from that to insults, then rape, threats and stuff like that all the time, I get it. And now with the new president that is like Trump in Spanish, we're getting exactly the same thing. It's like worse and worse. He's trying to discredit the media all the time. He's discrediting everyone that is critical of his office and critical of the problems, specifically the violence against women and children in Mexico. He's denying everything. And we are right now working on trying to bring him to understand that he cannot deny the truth. But what I do, basically, aside of being a good investigative reporter and writing books and listening to people, is teach people to be responsible to use internet. Whenever they are surfing, whenever they are sharing, they can do it in such a way that they can help others. So I decided to write a children's book. And it's not a children's book because now I found out that people are using them in schools, and then a lot of people that are like 30, 35, or 40 are buying the book and reading it because they think it's very useful. And it's a book about brave kids, brave girls and boys in school that find out a girl has disappeared from school. And this girl disappeared because she was posting her photos in Facebook, and then within the story, which is, you know, a short story, an investigative girl and boy, they just go there and they find out what happened to the girl because they are very savvy in you know, surfing the internet, in networking, and then they find where the girl is, and they go to the police and tell the police. And then all of a sudden, I have been invited to go to all these schools from Mexico to Panama to talk about the book with students that are fascinated by the book. And the trick of that book is very simple. It empowers them. It's not a book about scaring children and telling them nothing is going to happen, you are trapped in this hell of internet and nothing is happening. It's about what they just talked about. It's about what Maria just talked about. It's about all the solutions that we have found to save lives, to save our own lives and the lives of others. It's about the solutions that we find every time we type something in the internet to help somebody that has been abducted or a journalist kidnapped or somebody that is in danger somewhere in the world. It's about funding like 10 bucks a month, a news outlet that is different, that is doing good investigative reporting, for example, anywhere in the world, including creating ones in your own community, of course. My father asked me, he knew I was coming here, and he goes like, Mijita, my daughter, my little daughter, he called me Mijita, and he goes like, please, don't talk about the mobsters this time. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, I promise I won't. I swear, now I bet he's like in Facebook, like looking for me, like, oh my gosh, she's talking about it. He said, please talk about global warming or something like that. You know, the worst that can happen to you is they can say, oh, she's so, you know, she thinks you want to be Greta Thunberg, but like older. My dad asked me to be safe, and I do. Stay safe. I run away. Right now, I'm running away from home because I don't want to be killed, basically. And I want to go back eventually, or I also want to keep on investigating from wherever I am. I have a lot of work everywhere in the world. It's very tough. Sometimes, of course, I cry a lot. I feel lonely. I spend more money than I have, so I have to work a lot. But I think it's worth it. I absolutely believe that this is an important moment for humanity. And it has to be to do with the fact that we have to go back to repeating once a day, at least, the word ethics and values. And if we don't, we will waste our own times and maybe the lives of many, many people. So thank you so much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speakers were Maria Reza, CEO, executive editor, and founder of Rappler.com, and Lydia Cacho, an investigative journalist, social activist, and human rights advocate. They recently spoke at the 2020 Camden Conference, focusing on the 21st century media revolution. These talks, as well as all the other talks from this year's Camden Conference, can be found at camdenconference.org. If you missed part of today's program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock, Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.